This episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast is brought to you by StatHead. We've all had that moment when we look at a player's stats and it raises more questions. When did someone last hit for a cycle? How many pitchers had an ERA that low over any 20-game span? StatHead has the answers. StatHead is your all-access pass to go inside the Baseball Reference database and answer virtually any questions about baseball stats and history. Use code MLBTR for 20% off annual baseball or annual all sports subscriptions.
Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald, and drinks are on me because I just got poached by the Rima Sports Agency. With me this week is my MLBTR colleague, Steve Adams. How's it going, Steve?
It's going better after that lead-in. That was good. That was good. Again, not ready for that. You gotta give me a heads up on some of these.
Oh, I need the element of surprise.
The element of surprise does make it more entertaining. I was not ready for that.
Bad Bunny poached me. He gave me a car, allegedly.
I don't know that Bad Bunny himself was doing it. I don't know how involved he is with the actual day-to-day.
I don't know. It's true. Yeah. That's a little inside baseball stuff, but we had that on the site if you saw it. Some agent stuff. Anyway, let's not talk about that. Let's talk ball. I mean, here at MLB Trade Rumors, we're sick little freaks for the offseason.
Yes, we are.
And even though we just got our asses kicked in trying to predict the most recent offseason, and the current baseball season is only like 3 weeks old. We're already like, here's what's going to happen next winter. So we published a post on the site this week, the 2024-25 free agent power rankings, which is a thing. How long has MLB Trade Rumors been doing this? Do you know?
Oh, my gosh. Since before, like, I've been full-time at the site since 2013, and Tim was doing it, you know, before I joined the site in a full-time capacity. So, like, he and Ben Nicholson-Smith, now with Sportsnet, shout out to Ben, hello. I think they were doing this, I mean, I don't know the first year, but I mean, 2010, 2011, 2012, somewhere in there. But it's been a hot minute, anyway, that we've been doing this.
Okay, so since you were quarterbacking this thing, I wanted to have you on the pod to sort of get your thoughts on it. Looking at the top of the upcoming free agent class, how do you feel about it compared to the offseason that just transpired, and general thoughts?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a deeper class, certainly in terms of hitters. You know, last offseason, and one of the reasons, I think, and we talked about this on the, quote, mega podcast last week, where we had you and me and Tim and Anthony all on here together. One of the areas that we overcompensated was to say, you know, it's a really weak class for hitters. So the good bats that are out there are going to get a boost. And I think the offseason that transpired proved that modern front offices, even when faced with a shortage of supply and no shortage of demand, are still going to kind of say, well, we still think you're worth X. And just because there's not many good people out there, we're not going to pay you more than X. Like, that's, they weren't going to stretch to crazy boundaries just to make sure that they got to, you know, Teoscar Hernandez or one of the few good hitters who were out there. This upcoming class, you know, you just look at the names in our top 10 only. And we have, you know, Juan Soto, Alex Bregman, Pete Alonso, Cody Bellinger, Willy Adames. That's already, Ha-Seong Kim, already a better class of hitters, like, right there, than the entire offseason this past year. And then you get down into, you know, some of the honorable mentions. And, you know, Paul Goldschmidt is 37. He's a little older, but he's still, you know, if he has a typical Goldschmidt season, will, you know, command a pretty sizable short-term deal, I would imagine. Teoscar Hernandez will be back out there looking for the multi-year deal that eluded him. Reese Hoskins will be out there this time off of a hopefully healthy season, as opposed to off of the completely missed season with the ACL tear. Christian Walker is super underrated and will be a free agent. Again, a little bit older, but really good player. Gleyber Torres will be a 28-year-old free agent. Tyler O'Neill could have a bounce back year with the Red Sox. So there's much more potential just for the offensive side of this year's free agent class. And I think that'll just make for a more interesting dynamic over the course of the winter. So nothing's guaranteed, but broad strokes, it's a better free agent class than we saw last time around, even subtracting Shohei Ohtani and Yoshinobu Yamamoto from the top of the list.
It's really interesting in that because so many guys had to settle for short-term deals in the past winter, the class is almost essentially going to be the free agent class we just saw plus other guys. Yeah. So like four out of our top 10 are, you know, the Boris Four. I know you hate that term, but like,
I do,
you know,
and there's a new Boris Four this time around. So
a Boris Eight. You know, so like Snell and Montgomery and Bellinger and Chapman are all going to be back in the mix. Oh, I guess Chapman's on the honorable mention.
So he's an honorable mention. Yeah.
So three out of the top 10 then are guys who were just free agents just as of like a few weeks ago. Yeah. And then even in the bats, like you mentioned, like it's a better crop of bats, but some of the best bats from the winter that we just saw, like Teoscar Hernandez and Rhys Hoskins, are going to be back out there again. In addition to these new guys, Pete Alonso and Alex Bregman and all of that.
Potentially with Hoskins. I guess we shouldn't. He has the player option. So it's not a straight 1 year deal for him. But
there's lots of options up and down this year because it's Hoskins and then Snell and Bellinger and Montgomery. There's lots of guys here who may not be free agents, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about opt-outs, there's a big asterisk footnote thing at the bottom of the piece that maybe we should at least touch on for a second because Gerrit Cole is potentially in the mix.
Yes.
But it's like in order for him to be a free agent, a very specific set of circumstances would have to arise. Yes. Do you want to tell our listeners about that?
Yeah. So Cole has 4 years and $188 million left on his contract after this season. You know, he signed what was at the time the largest pitching contract ever before Yamamoto beat him by $1 million this past offseason. But Cole can opt out of that contract, the final 4 years of his 9 year contract. But the Yankees can also supersede that by tacking on the 10th year option at another $36 million, which is, you know, his contract is just a straight 9 years, $36 million a year. They can tack on a 10th year, $36 million more to keep him around. I think for a long time, for a while anyway, that seemed like the logical outcome, especially after he won the Cy Young last year. It was, well, he goes out and has a Gerrit Cole season, he's going to probably try to opt out. The Yankees will say, nope, we'd like to keep you. We know we're taking on probably some unwanted years at the end, but we still think you have, you know, at least two, three great years left in you. Now that he's on the 60-day injured list until sometime in June, in all likelihood, it does throw a wrench into things because to become a free agent would basically need to come back, pitch quite well, well enough that he thinks he basically has $200+ million on the open market for him, and yet also give the Yankees enough of an injury scare, or perhaps just, you know, maybe they're looking at their long-term payroll and they're thinking, well, maybe we'd rather reallocate these funds to Juan Soto, for instance, but give them enough reason to not want to add on that 10th year, basically. So he needs to come back healthy. He needs to pitch well enough to think that there's $200 million out there, but not so well that the Yankees can't possibly say, well, there's no way we can let you get away. So it's a very narrow window, I feel like, for things to play out that way. But it's not impossible, especially if the Yankees do just say, hey, we love you, and we love the Cy Young last year, and thank you for everything that you've done for us, but you're in your mid-30s, and we also do really want to, you know, throw the vault at Soto and try to keep him here for the long run. So I think there's a small possibility things play out like that, but it would need to go a very specific set of ways, as you said.
Right. Okay, well, on the list, in putting it together, was there anyone who jumped out at you as a particularly like interesting case? I know we had some debates about Pete Alonso, but yeah. I don't know. What did you think when writing it up? What struck you?
So I think, you know, when the four of us were talking, the four of us being myself, Dara, Tim Dirkus, and Anthony Franco, I feel like Alex Bregman and Pete Alonso were, oh, this is a terrible pun, and I can't wait to use it. Didn't even plan it in advance, but we're polarizing. Hey, because Pete's the polar bear. Get it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Jokes are always funnier when you spell them out. So I think I'm a little higher just on their general earning power. And I understand being a little bit gun shy kind of after the way that the most recent offseason played out. But I think there's a very plausible scenario where Bregman hits the market and still signs for $200 million plus. You know, Tim kind of pointed out that the list of players who signed a $200 million plus contract beginning in their age 31 season, which Bregman will be as a free agent. He'll be heading into his age 31 season. That list is almost non-existent, and it's a good point. And I think we've seen teams kind of, you know, increasingly shy away from some of those long-term commitments. Some of last year's contracts were a little bit of an exception, the Trey Turner and Xander Bogaerts deals that were kind of artificially lengthened to tamp down the annual value for luxury purposes. But like, I look at Bregman and I do agree with kind of the perception that, okay, maybe he's like, quote, on the decline a little bit because he's not necessarily that annual MVP candidate that he was for around 3 years at his peak in his, you know, early to mid 20s. But he's still a pretty consistent, just like, you know, 4 to 5 wins above replacement kind of guy, with no real major flaws in his game. You know, Anthony brought up the point that like he's kind of tailored his swing to take advantage of the Crawford boxes, the short porch in left field at Houston's Minute Maid Park. And there might be some truth to that. But if you look at his career splits, like he's actually hit for more power on the road than he has at home. He has some of the best bat to ball skills, some of the best contact skills in the game. He's one of the toughest strikeouts in baseball. He draws a healthy amount of walks, has above average power, can still play a really nice third base. And even if you feel like eventually he's going to have to move off of that, like I think you can look at him and see somebody who can shift to second base or left field. So I do think 7 or 8 year deal that takes him over the $200 million mark is plausible. I don't know if I would say it's likely. He needs to have, you know, a really nice season to get there, but I do think it's possible. Alonso is a little trickier because teams are just increasingly wary of paying kind of the all bat guys who have no real defensive value. And I do think that, not knocking Alonso as a player, but he's not an elite defensive first baseman. And even if he was, you know, you're talking about a guy who's first base only and who's going to be signing through his age 35, 36 season. It's not the defensive side of that is not going to factor heavily into what he commands on the market. I think it's possible that some team, probably the Mets, just kind of falls in love with the home run profile, and they have the obvious motivation to keep him with, you know, Steve Cohen, lifelong Mets fan and richer than God owner, may just want to keep him regardless. And that could put Alonso and Boris in a good position. But it's also definitely possible that the market could just look at him and say, is this somebody that we want to go 8+ years on or 7+ years on even, and might react a little bit more tepidly and kind of say, okay, like, no, we think this is more of a 5 or a 6 year deal that's going to only run into your mid 30s. And the $30 million a year price point doesn't really apply to all bat players like this. You know, like even like Freddie Freeman and Paul Goldschmidt are good defensive players who hit for a higher average and have better on base percentages than Alonso. And yes, they were 32 years old when they started their contracts, but they got $26 and $27 million annually on those deals. You know, Freeman on the open market and Goldschmidt as an extension. So I do think it's also possible that the stopping point or the target really for Boris and for Alonso is to just kind of nudge ahead of those two in terms of beating Freeman's guarantee and or maybe slightly pushing past on the average annual value. But I think, you know, and I get asked a lot by Mets fans in the chats on the site, and I, you know, they throw numbers around like, you know, $240 million or something for Pete Alonso. And I don't think that is going to be there, but I think there's a perception because he's such a prodigious slugger, I think some people just assume that's going to be the case. So there's a wide range of outcomes with him. I think 200 is kind of the upper threshold of where I can see him landing. But I think I said something like 6 years at 165 would give him an AAV that tops both Freeman and Goldschmidt and slightly pushes him past Freeman's overall guarantee. And I think you would still have to call that, you know, a nice contract and a win for Alonso and Boris.
Yeah. And as we just saw in the most recent offseason, a couple of question marks can be enough to drastically change the whole thing. Yeah. And we didn't even really talk about the top two because, I mean, I don't know, there's not that much to say, really. I mean, Juan Soto and Corbin Burns are one and two, and they're up there because they're great.
Yeah, and I don't know that I can see almost any scenario where Soto falls from the top spot on the list. Like, even if he missed the season with an injury, I feel like people would still say, well, he's Juan Soto and he's going to be like 26 years old next year. Like, who cares, like, what injury he had?
I think if a crocodile ate one of his legs, I would bump him out of the top spot. Yes. But short of that.
Mm-hmm. Like, a crocodile ate one of his feet and he got like popped with a PED suspension and he tore the ACL in his other leg. Like, okay, well then maybe we, but there's not a lot of crocodiles in the Bronx, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, but he's just been so good. I mean, he's just, every year he like walks and hits home runs. It's like, as long as he just does his normal thing, he'll easily be at the top spot.
Yeah, especially just because, like, I think people who are kind of his detractors, like, well, why should he get this money? Because he's 25 years old right now. He's going to play all of next season at 26, which is just insanity when you think about how good he's already been since he was 19 years old. It's just crazy. So
it is wild. I was just because one of our readers had emailed us asking a question about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And so in my response to them, I pointed out that, you know, Vladdy's 25 right now. He's in his age 25 season. Aaron Judge, going into his age 25 season, had played in 27 Major League Baseball games. Yeah. And he struck out at a 44.2% rate. And look at how much he accomplished after his age 25 season. So, like, guys like Vlad and Juan Soto right now have already accomplished so much at a time when Aaron Judge had done like almost nothing.
Yeah.
And so, like, there's still, so theoretically, there's still so much more they could continue to develop, which is insane to think about with Soto.
Yeah. And I think, like, the age 25 point is a good one, but even I think I wrote, I shouldn't say I think, I have the thing in front of me. I wrote in the power rankings piece, like, Soto will be 26 for his entire first free agent year. And when Judge was heading into his age 26 season, he had 773 big league plate appearances. So like, it's just the gap is just, it's ridiculous. And Judge still got $360 million and you know, deservedly so after that season that he had and the pre-free agency, just general body of work that he had. But yeah, you could sign Soto to, you know, a 5 or 6 year deal and you're not even getting any decline years. So like, he's going to probably get 12, 13, 14 years because that's just what it's going to take. And teams are going to know, okay, well, we're getting 7, 8, 9 prime aged years before we really even need to start thinking about the quote decline phase. And with a hitter this good, who knows if he's even going to have a standard decline phase.
Yeah. All right. Well, check out that piece if you haven't already. And we will do, I don't know, a couple more versions of the power rankings throughout the year as situations change. We'll revisit.
Yeah, I don't know that it's I think we always kind of go into it like, oh, we'll do it monthly. And it usually ends up being like, well, we did like 4 installments over the course of the year. It's a labor of love and has kind of grown into a larger undertaking than it was several years ago, but I think it's good to, you know, check on where things stand because a lot can change over the course of the season. I remember at the beginning of last year, one of the debates we were having was whether Blake Snell belonged on the power ranking list, and I think you and I were kind of stumping for him and kind of getting some pushback, and you know, 6 months later, it's like, well, he won the Cy Young. So yeah, he's going to be on there. All right. But it just goes to show how much things can change over the course of a year.
But then also like he won the Cy Young, but then also like that uncertainty that existed going into the 2023 season seemingly followed him, even though he won the Cy Youngs because he didn't get the big deal that he was looking for. So, correct. You know, he'll be
looking for it again next offseason in all likelihood and maybe get it then. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's turn then to some news. Pretty big piece of news that we should address because we also talked about it on the podcast before when stuff was coming out. The latest on Ippei Mizuhara, who was Shohei Ohtani's interpreter until this gambling stuff came out. So the most recent developments from last week are that he's been officially charged with bank fraud. Mm-hmm. And the full complaint against him, which I believe was compiled by an IRS agent, was released to the public. So anybody could read it. It was sent out by the Washington Post and other people. It is a wild read. I read it. You read the whole thing, Steve?
Yeah, it is one of the more... I mean, I don't make a habit of reading, you know, lengthy 37-page court briefings very often, but it is a wild sequence of events, and just the sheer volume of text messages between Mizuhara and the bookkeepers that he was placing all this insane number of bets with. It's incredible. Like it's a really, I know there's a lot of skepticism. And some of which I had, like, honestly, like when this was all coming out, the manner in which the story changed so abruptly early on, I think raised flags for some people. But, you know, Tim Durkas said in a text message to you know, our team, kind of, you know, I just read through all 37 pages of that. And I find it hard to believe that, like, you could, unless you just were dead set, no matter what, in your mind, like, Ohtani's guilty. I want him to be guilty, so he's guilty, and nothing's going to change my mind. It's hard to believe somebody could go into that document with an open mind, read it, and then come away thinking, like, oh, yeah, this is all a giant scam and a cover-up for Ohtani. He was in on the whole thing. And after having read it myself, you know, agree with that. And I know your comment was, I think you said something along the lines of, like, the main crime that I see him committing was you know, trusting someone too much or having bad judgment and who to trust or whatever your, I don't remember your exact term terminology there, but I would agree with that sentiment. It is a wild ride, particularly the section with just all the text messages.
Yeah. You know, I consider myself an open-minded person, so maybe some new evidence will come to light.
Yeah.
But at this point in time, approximately 100% of the evidence points to Shohei Ohtani being completely innocent. And approximately 100% of the evidence points to Mizuhara being completely guilty. So maybe something will come out and change that. But this document is just wild because it has all the receipts. It just goes through point by point of, like, he met the bookie on this date and he changed the settings on the bank account on this date so that it was his email instead of Ohtani's. They have a recorded phone call of him calling the bank and pretending to be Ohtani and saying, change the email to my email. They have all these text messages between Mizuhara and the bookie being like, I'm going to send you this amount tomorrow. And then there's, like, a record of a bank transfer of that amount going from Ohtani's account to the guy. And then they have all of the text messages between Ohtani and Mizuhara going back years. And there is, like, literally not one reference to anything gambling related at any point. They did not discuss odds. They didn't talk about a bookie. They didn't talk about gambling, nothing. So it's just like, I mean, it's just airtight. So if you're one of those people who's still convinced that Ohtani's guilty, the only thing, you're not doing it based on evidence at this point. You're doing it just based on vibes and, I don't know, some vague sense that all of the evidence is somehow faked and that the IRS and the FBI are in on some big scam with Rob Manfred somehow. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think too, one of the things that people, one of the most common things, you know, is you see people saying, well, how could you possibly not know $16 million went missing? Yes. And it's like, I think to myself, like, cause I have similar thoughts, like, right away. Like if even, you know, a few hundred dollars were $1,000, whatever went missing from my bank account, I would know. But, like, I'm also not making $70 million per year in endorsements off the field. Plus, last year, you know, he had a $30 million salary. And again, that's $16 million over the course of 3 years. So it's really, you know, okay, $5 million per year kind of. And when you start breaking it down by, like, you know, how much was actually missing per, you know, pay stub or paycheck or whatever, it becomes easier to see, okay, well, maybe it's not such a glaring number relative to how much money he's taking in. And also, I mean, the guy made over $100 million last year alone. And so to think that he's checking his bank account every day when he has that kind of money. Like, you pay people to do that for you. And in this case, one of the people that he was paying to do that for him was Ippe Mizuhara. And like, I know people say, well, he was his interpreter. Like, why does he have access to all these things? And that was his title. But this guy was also like one of his closest friends and confidant, and was in charge of far more than just like what you would think the general scope of an interpreter would handle. And so, go ahead.
I was just going to say, they also lay out directly how this happened with the bank account thing in the document. It's that Mizuhara and Ohtani in 2018, they went to the bank. Ohtani wanted to open up a bank account so that his salary with the Angels could be directly deposited into a bank account. And he didn't speak English, so he needed Mizuhara to go with him to help him open the account. And then over the years, as you said, he's making all these endorsements and stuff. He has a team full of like agents and accountants and stuff. He assumed that they were on top of all of his banking. And then they went to Mizuhara multiple times and were like, can we take a look at that bank account? We need to check it for tax purposes. And he and Mizuhara told them, Ohtani wants to keep it secret. And they were like, okay, but we need to look for like tax purposes to see if it's collecting interest or if he's given out any gifts or anything that will affect his tax status. And Mizuhara was like, it's not collecting interest. There's no gifts. Ohtani doesn't want you to look at it. And they were just like, okay, I guess. And so it was this bizarre situation where nobody on Ohtani's team spoke Japanese, which is probably the biggest screw up in this whole thing.
Yes.
And so anytime they tried to contact him, Mizuhara just lied to them. And so they weren't getting the accurate information about Ohtani's situation. And then Ohtani didn't know what was going on because he was like, I thought my accountants were looking at my stuff. So why did I have to worry about my bank account? And so nobody, like the filter of information between Ohtani and his team always went through Mizuhara. And so it was never good information at any point.
Yeah, never good information going either way. Like not good information going to Ohtani, and not good information going to his agents, his accountants, everybody else in his entourage or whatever term you want to use. I think it's just like flabbergasting that it's basically just the lone Japanese speaking link between, you know, this best player in the sport and one of the most recognizable athletes in the world, and his team of direct representatives and all these and people working for it was this one interpreter. That is maybe the hardest part of the whole thing to believe, because you would just think, even not suspecting Mizuhara of anything, which I'm sure, like, you know, Ohtani's agents and everyone didn't, but that's so much work and so much heavy lifting for one guy to do. You would think they would just want a larger team to kind of just split up the workload a little bit.
Or even just by accident, having like a PR person who speaks Japanese because you know, Ohtani's getting endorsements from Japanese company or whatever. So if somebody was just in the room, like they weren't hired specifically because they spoke Japanese, but they just happened to, and if they were in the room when Mizuhara was doing something shady, you know, but apparently that never happened.
Yeah. It's, I understand, fully how somebody can look at it from the outside and say these pieces don't add up and this, but like I would just say, if you have skepticism and you have doubt about it, which, like, I admittedly, like when all this was coming out, I kind of was looking at it with an eyebrow raised, like, this just, so much here doesn't seem right, how could all this add up? But yeah, you go and you read the court documents and it is eye-opening, I would say.
Okay, so it seems like, again, unless some new information comes out, Major League Baseball is dodging a big bullet here. And I don't necessarily have a question for you here, Steve, but I just want to say that I feel like the bullet is going to land at some point. And I'm just going to say that, like, in this case, like the big Pete Rose, like Black Sox scandal that people worried about when the news first started coming out, seems like it's not going to happen. And, it's looking like Ohtani's going to be completely exonerated. But at some point, gambling is just so prevalent now. Yeah. I was watching, you know, on MLB TV, they got that thing, Big Inning. Do you know this thing?
Yep, I do, yeah.
I was watching that because they got the four, they have the screen split into the four quadrants, and they're showing you four different games at once. But then every once in a while, they just, one of the quadrants is just like live odds from MGM and whatever. And it's just like gambling is just so baked into modern sports now that at some point, somebody is going to get caught with their hands in the cookie jar. I don't know who it's going to be. It seems like it's not Otani, but somebody at some point, we're going to be having some sort of Pete Rose conversation at some point. And that's it. Yeah, like I said, I don't have a question, but if you agree or disagree.
No, it's not something that I like have thought extensively about. But I mean, since it was kind of incorporated into the fabric of, you know, North American professional sports and you kind of just accepted and legalized and popularized, it has seemed like, yeah, we're gonna be trending toward something along those lines at some point. And it, of course, we don't know who it's going to be or when it's going to be. There's no way of knowing that, but the sheer amount of financial gain that's possible, you know, it's mm-hmm. someone's always going to be looking for that edge, and someone's always going to be looking for,
you or know, it might be addiction, like we saw. Like it seems like with Mizuhara.
Oh my gosh! Like
he was addicted.
Some of the texts that he was sending, he's like, "Yeah, I just started betting on soccer because there's games 24/7. I don't know anything about it. LOL to this." And it's like, why are you? Can I get another 500K bump, by the way? And the bookie's just like, "Sure."
Yeah. He admits that he has a problem to
multiple times, over and over. He admits that he has a problem and that he's terrible at gambling. And he's like up at, you know, God knows what time of night, like 3 a.m. betting on, you know, European amateur volleyball games and stuff or whatever, because he just needs to fulfill that that itch. So it's there will at some point be some prominent scandal, and I think that, I mean, that extends beyond Major League Baseball as well. Like you'll start to see more of that.
I think there's already in other sports. I think I'm such an idiot when it comes to other sports, but I'm pretty sure somebody on the Raptors is in some kind of scandal right now.
You're a Torontonian. You should have the full breakdown of this entire. Come on.
I'm terrible at having my head up baseball.
That's what I tell everyone. I tell everyone, Dara McDonald, that guy is terrible. Just hard stop. End of the sentence.
But I do want to give a shout out because it really made me laugh. Like you and I and Tim and Anthony were texting about this Otani thing as the news was coming out. And I talked about how Mizuhara admitted that he had a problem to his bookie many times, like jokingly, you know, like, oh, I have a problem, LOL. And then Anthony responded with, I'm shocked that our friendly neighborhood bookmaker one did not immediately refer him to helpful counseling services at that point. but anyway, enough about that. Another thing that's baseball adjacent that we should talk about because it's pretty big news. I mean, it's not related to actually like on-field results or whatever. Sure. Okay. It's not like we're not talking about batting averages or earned run averages here. But the A's are going to Sacramento for 3 years. Now, there's a word, like you and I, Steve, have been messaging about this thing. And there's a certain word that I think both of us have used. It's one syllable. I can't say the first one, but the second syllable is show. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have some idea, yes.
Okay. So this seems so very unnecessary because they already have, I mean, the stadium in Oakland is obviously not in great shape, but it is a major league stadium. And it seems like for the purposes of bargaining leverage, they are intentionally going to leave Oakland and go to Sacramento to play in a worse facility. Since the news came out, all these players have been coming out to talk about how much of a downgrade it is, even though, you know, Oakland has its issues. Going to this AAA facility in Sacramento and playing there for 3 years before they move to Vegas is not going to be pretty.
No. And I mean, you kind of joked a little bit or mentioned that, well, we're not talking about something that impacts on field results. And I mean, it does in a lot of ways.
Right.
I mean, I don't know that the A's would be pushing to sign a lot of guys and free, you know, high quality free agents. Anyway, they certainly don't make a concerted effort in that field on the regular anyhow, but it's going to be like every player's last choice. You're going to go to this team, play in a AAA stadium where the clubhouses aren't even connected to the dugouts. They're out on the other side of the outfield wall. So like, you can't even like, you know, take the quick trip from the dugout down into the clubhouse for anything. Like, The training facilities are smaller. The weight rooms are smaller. The clubhouses themselves are smaller. The lighting is going to be an issue, and like they'll have to do. I'm sure they will do a bunch of work to, you know, bring the facility up to major league standards, much as the Blue Jays did during the pandemic season. Mm-hmm. So they'll make, you know, improvements to the lighting and whatever. But there are some, you know, just fundamental aspects like the clubhouses being not connected to the dugouts and just the sheer like smaller size of them and everything. Those aren't things you can super easily change. And those are going to be big things for free agents when they're thinking about, you know, where do I want to sign? Even if you're somebody who's not necessarily in high demand, but you know, the A's do sign some players, like usually, you know, kind of smaller term one year deals and 2 year deals. But I mean, if you're looking at that situation and thinking, okay, I mean, hey, they're technically offering me whatever, $1.5 million more, $2 million more, whatever, than this other team. But this other club's playing in an actual major league stadium. And mm-hmm. by the way, might not, you know, lose 110 games this year. Like it's really going to make it tough. This, I guess, presumes that the A's are even going to try to field a winning team, which they clearly aren't doing right now. But like you would think as they inch closer to this new, you know, Las Vegas stadium and everything, that they're going to want to have a better product on the field for their inaugural season in Las Vegas, assuming everything, you know, finally goes off as is planned right now, and the stadium opens on schedule in 2028. And it's going to be hard, I think, to they're going to have to operate pretty expressly on the trade market, or just, you know, make some really dubious long-term commitments that probably won't end well if they want to, you know, overpay substantially, which again doesn't seem like something that's going to be in the A's playbook. It's going to be tough, and I do think it'll have like a fairly obvious impact on just the roster building aspect.
Right. Well, my condolences to the people of Oakland, because it seems like
it sucks. I mean, people joke like, oh, nobody goes to A's games, they don't have fans anyway, but they do, and they have like a pretty rabid fan base out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough to, you know, I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and you know, the talk of contracting the Twins was a big thing that I remember from my childhood in the 90s. And just as a kid, even though the Twins were terrible every year, like just the thought of losing that team and losing the ability to go to baseball games with my dad and my brothers and my friends, like that was just like heart-wrenching to me as a young baseball fan. And there's a lot of those in Oakland right now who are just and who just won't understand this and won't understand why is my team going away? You know, like, and that's, I think about those kids. Like I think about, you know, the 8 and 9 and 10 year olds who just want to go to the park and just experience baseball, and who it's a thing for them to do with their friends. It's a way to make memories, and that's being taken away from them. And that's hard, and that sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, up here in Canada, I know a bunch of people who still mourn the loss of the Expos. What's happening now, like that was the last time this happened mm-hmm. in Major League Baseball, was the Expos getting moved to Washington, and you know, it was heartbreaking for all of those Expos fans. Okay, well, let's get to your questions. We got a question here from Will, who says, how can a pitcher blow a save in the seventh inning? How early can a save be blown? And there's a little parenthetical in their question. They said Jay Piamps 4/3/2024. So I guess Joel Piamps got a blown save in the seventh inning a couple weeks ago, and Will doesn't understand how that could be possible.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, when you're, that's the same way, like, to be credited with a hold, you have to be in a save situation, basically, and you know, kind of keep the line rolling to the closer who's going to close things out and get that save. So, you know, we kind of had that like fun little thought exercise before we started recording or whatever, where you were talking about the just catastrophe start that Hunter Brown had last week, where he gave up whatever it was, 9 runs in the first inning and was yanked. And we kind of joked about, well, in theory, if, you know, so they bring in whoever to get out of the inning, and then somehow in the next half of the inning, the Astros put up, you know, 10 runs or 11 runs of their own, and so they're suddenly, you know, technically have a two-run lead, like, you are technically at that point in a safe situation for the next pitcher who comes out. If it's a new pitcher, if you enter with, you know, that two-run lead or whatever, technically, if that guy pitches the final eight innings of that game and they win, like, that would be an insane but eight-inning save. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't think there's really any, like, hard limit on when it could actually happen in theory. I don't think you're going to see that ever elusive eight inning save anytime soon, but I mean, like, mm-hmm. it technically is possible, I suppose, right?
Yeah, the definition of a save is if you come in after the pitcher of record, so the pitcher in line for the win, then it's technically a save situation because you could pitch the rest of the game. And I just looked it up while we were talking, and there was in 2002 a seven inning save.
Oh, wow.
Joaquin Benoit. Whoa. In September 3rd of 2002, Joaquin Benoit relieved Todd Van Poppel, who came into the first inning of the game after the starter Aaron Mayette was ejected. So Benoit came in to relieve Van Poppel, who got the win, in the third. And so Benoit pitched seven innings and got the save.
That's wild. I mean, that is some grade A, just obscure baseball trivia right there.
Okay, we got another question here from Dan, who says, do you think the Tigers will release Javi Baez? It is painful to watch him. I don't doubt the second part, Dan. But what do you think, Steve?
No, I don't think they will, because, I mean, there's no, if you could, if baseball allowed some kind of system where even you could, you know, by releasing the player, even be spared 10% of the contract or 15% of the contract or something, then yeah, I think you'd see a lot more releases in situations like this, but they're going to be paying him regardless. And as difficult as he has been to watch at the plate, he can still play a pretty mean shortstop. If you really wanted to, even if you had somebody come up who was, you know, kind of clearly pushed him off that everyday shortstop role, you could still, you know, Baez is a good enough defender, still has some speed, I guess. Like, you could still, you know, use him as a bench player. And, you know, I imagine there are probably some Tigers fans who, and of course, like, you're just sick of seeing the reminder of the bad contract and everything, and you just want to move on and turn the page. But, like, if you get rid of Baez and go sign Ahmed Rosario or Nick Ahmed or whoever, you know, pick a, or G, oh, they did sign Gio Urshela, but, like, you know, one of the cheap, you know, kind of infielders who you could maybe, you know, use in a utility capacity late in the offseason, you're still paying that $23 million or whatever to Baez, and then you're just paying $2 million to a light hitting utility infielder on top of that. And so there's no real reason that they need to do it until they absolutely need that roster spot, and they just have had so many young players come up that there's just no justifiable reason to keep Baez on the roster. And I can see that happening at some point, given the, you know, the Tigers have a lot of promising prospects working their way through the upper minors right now. I don't think we're at that point yet, and it's obviously unlikely, and Tigers fans will roll their eyes, but you keep him on the roster, you leave open the possibility that he at least plays well enough for a span of 3 or 4 months that some other team says, oh, well, maybe there's a little bit left in the tank here, and yeah, we'll take him the final, you know, 2 years of his contract off your hands for, you know, $2.5 million per season or something like that, and then you at least save a little bit of money. It's probably not likely, but I mean, we do see it happen. You know, the Orioles bailed out the Mets on $2.5 million per year of the last 2 years of that James McCann contract that just really went about as poorly as possible for the Mets. And if they had cut him a year and a half in, or like a lot of Mets fans were clamoring for, then you don't end up, you know, finding that small scale trade down the line and saving yourself a little bit of that money. And, you know, if you're a luxury paying team like the Mets, that $2.5 million is actually more like, you know, $5 something million every year when you factor in the luxury taxes. So I understand the frustration of watching somebody who's clearly on an underwater contract and who just can't perform anywhere near how he used to be able to. But I just don't see a short-term or near-term scenario where the Tigers are just going to cut bait on Baez with this much of his contract remaining. Once you get to the point where there's only 1 year to go, I think at that point all bets are off. And sure, you can more easily say, okay, we're just going to move on. But in general, when there's multiple years left on one of these kind of albatross contracts, it's really rare to see the team just cut bait and say, all right, we're done with this here.
All right. Question here from Nicholas, who wants to know who Atlanta could target inside or outside the organization to replace Spencer Strider. Most fans probably know by now, but Spencer Strider required internal brace surgery on his damaged UCL and is going to miss the rest of the year, which puts Atlanta in a tricky spot in their rotation.
Putting things quite mildly, but to take the question very literally, you're not going to replace Spencer Strider. He's one of the five, three, however many, take your arbitrary cutoff. He's one of the very best pitchers in baseball. And no one that you bring in is going to, unless you somehow get the Orioles to trade you Corbin Burns, which isn't happening. But you're not going to replace that production. I think in the short term, you'll see them mostly stick in-house just because there aren't going to be many teams peddling legitimate starting pitching options this early in the season. The trade market just really rarely picks up for the summer months because teams want to know, have a better sense of their playoff chances, have a lengthier look at their own prospects when they're determining, okay, who are we going to be willing to trade away, et cetera, et cetera. They want to, they want to wait till there's a competitive market. The sellers want to wait till there's a competitive market and enough teams buying. The buyers want to wait until there are alternatives. So they're not just saying, well, there's one guy on the market and we have to pay whatever, this team wants to get him. So it's hard for major trades like that to come early in the season. I think as you move closer to the trade deadline, I doubt there will be a, starting pitcher of note who hits the market that the Braves aren't linked to in some capacity. The rotation, just without Strider, it just looks so much dicier. Max Fried pitched 77 innings last year because of the forearm strain. Chris Sale hasn't been healthy in God knows how long, 5 years really. Reynaldo Lopez is a converted starter to reliever, now back to starter. So who knows how many innings they can realistically count on from him. You'll probably see a lot of AJ Smith-Schauber over the first, several months of the season. And then as the trade market picks up, it's a little early to tell exactly who's going to be on there, but the Marlins, granted they're in the NL East with the Braves, but basically any pitcher in that rotation, Jesus Luzardo chief among them, is probably going to be on the market. Anybody who has, more than 2 years of service time under his belt at this point for the Marlins is probably going to be up there. The A's will have Paul Blackburn on the market. I think the White Sox, who, the Braves obviously have a good trading relationship with. They've made a few different moves with them recently. Garrett Crochet is going to be somebody who's really interesting to me. He's another, probably going to have some kind of innings workload, but has 2 years of control left beyond this current season. And this has looked really, really good to start the year. And I think the White Sox know it's quite unlikely that they're really going to be competing for much in the remaining window of control that they have over Crochet. So I don't know. I'm trying to come up off the cuff here right now. Who am I missing here, Dara? Help me out. Who are some other names that we're going to see on the market in a few months?
I think you touched on the main ones. I could see the Red Sox maybe moving some of their guys if they fall out of it.
Pivetta, if he's healthy, like he's coming up on a contract year here.
I guess it depends. There's so many teams where it depends whether they're in or out.
The Angels will have some guys who I don't expect the Angels to be in, and Patrick Sandoval only has 2 years remaining after this year. Griffin Canning, kind of surprisingly and quietly, like much like it kind of snuck up on people that Garrett Crochet only has 2 years of club control remaining beyond this year. Griffin Canning only has one after this year. So he's somebody else who can, you know, you can conceivably see, you know, on the trade market this summer as well.
Yeah. I mean, the Mets as well. I mean, again, it's also tough with the interdivisional thing, but they got Quintana and Severino and Sean Manaea, who are all potential trade candidates if the Mets are not in it.
Yeah, and then none of those guys are long-term pieces there. Manaea will be hard to trade just because he has the player option, and that kind of always makes it tough for the two teams to align on value. But yeah, the Mets are a good call there. And I don't think, since Quintana and Severino are, you know, just one-year guys, I don't think they would, you know, shy away from dealing with the Braves. The Braves might balk at sending, you know, a prospect that they like to the Mets, but the Mets certainly would be willing, I would think, to send Jose Quintana or Luis Severino to Atlanta.
Yeah, but it all depends how the next few months play out, because so many teams could go, you know, with the expanded playoffs, there's so many teams who, you know, if they're hot through June, then they're in, and if they have a terrible June, then suddenly they're putting pieces on the table, so we'll see. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks so much for joining me, Steve.
Thank you for having me, and I would look forward to doing it again. Thank you to all of our listeners out there. You guys are awesome, and I say this sometimes when, you know, writing things for front office or whenever I do the chats with our subscribers, but it's really cool, and it's really like humbling for me and for us, I think, to just like have people who want to tune in and listen to our insane ramblings on a podcast like this, or to read the things that we write for our, you know, our subscription or our subscribers and stuff. It's really cool. So we appreciate the support here at MLBTR, and you guys are the best.
Well said. So we'll have another episode next week. In the meantime, MLBTradeRumors.com has all the transactions and everything. And the front office package means you get rid of the ads and support us, and you get extra stuff, and you can use the contract tracker. So do that. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.